Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for listening to The World. You already know that our team works hard to find fresh angles and unique voices when we bring you the news. Our stories are global, but we aim to keep the focus local, with the people on the ground living close to the day's events. We're able to keep our coverage free and accessible and reach millions of people each week because listeners like you support our nonprofit newsroom. This is our fall fundraising drive, which means it is the perfect time to donate. If you give before November 30th and help us reach our goal, your gift will be matched. That means your support will go twice as far in helping us bring you the news. So if you've been thinking about donating but haven't yet, now is your chance. We can't do this without you. Visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
After the January 6th Capitol insurrection, federal agents went looking for suspects. They couldn't find them all.
48-year-old Evan Newman of Mill Valley. He is charged with attacking police at the U.S. Capitol this year.
Newman has now turned up in Belarus, and thousands of Afghans who helped the U.S. are still trapped in Afghanistan, hoping for help and hiding from the Taliban.
2 nights ago, they were searching the alley beside us, and I was awake all night.
We'll hear from that man who's sheltering in a basement. Also today, American Muslims go abroad to better understand their faith, plus books with odd titles, and the only heavy metal band in Togo, West Africa. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here. The leaders of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico are meeting at the White House today. It is the first trilateral summit in 5 years for these North American neighbors.
Nos vamos a entrevistar con el presidente Biden y con el primer ministro Trudeau.
Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador talked about his priorities before heading to Washington.
Lo de el acuerdo comercial.
López Obrador says trade remains a top agenda item, but that's far from being the only contentious issue between the three countries. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia is on the line with us from Mexico City. First of all, Jorge, what do we know about the status and just overall tone of the relations between Presidents Biden, López Obrador, and Prime Minister Trudeau?
Well, Marco, just the fact that they are meeting alone says that the relationship is at the very least cordial right now. It's nowhere near being as contentious or antagonistic as it was in the days when President Donald Trump was using trade as a stick to get what he wanted from his neighbors. But that's not to say that there aren't competing interests. There are very many different perspectives on how to handle very complex issues, such as mass migration from the global south, whether and how to collaborate on pandemic response, or on the very, very complex issue of trade.
Let's remember that the USMCA was once called NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So break that down. For these parties, how important is trade?
Oh, it's a huge deal. And I can give you two examples on that right now. The first one is that President Biden is proposing tax incentives for people in the United States to buy U.S.-made electric cars. And as soon as his administration rolled that out, there was a strong response from the top levels of government in Canada. Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland said that Biden's proposal goes against the spirit of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, which was signed just a few years ago.
The way they have formulated this incentive really, really has the potential to become the dominant issue in our bilateral relationship.
That's Canadian Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland clearly pointing out that this is a very contentious point between Canada and the United States. Now, between Mexico and the United States, President López Obrador here is proposing policies that favor very much the state-owned oil and utility companies. And the U.S.'s ambassador to Mexico has said that those policies very much go against the spirit of the USMCA. So, like I said, competing interests.
You also mentioned migration, Jorge. How do the parties see their various roles and positions on migration?
Well, migration is a perennial issue. And for the United States right now, President Biden has continued many of the controversial policies that were put in place under the Trump administration, one of them being that they want people who petition for asylum on the southwest border to wait for their asylum hearings on the Mexican side of the border. Now, Mexico has leverage in this issue because Mexico is very much helps the United States in this regard. In southern Mexico, Mexico's National Guard has become a very capable extension of U.S. border enforcement because the National Guard in Mexico patrols areas near the border with Guatemala, and they stop people who are entering from Guatemala. They come from Central America, other parts of the global south. They want to go to the United States, but they stop them there so that they don't even have an opportunity to get to the U.S. border. So for better or for worse, this issue has become a bargaining chip between the relationship between Mexico and the United States, and it comes up whenever they are discussing other bilateral issues.
Well, when President Biden and Vice President Harris came into office in January, they said they wanted to address the root causes of migration. Are the U.S. and Mexico working on this?
It's not entirely clear how they are doing that, because Mexican President López Obrador has said that he wants to get support to extend a couple of programs that he started in Mexico to extend those to Central America. This is something that the two countries have been talking about, addressing the root causes of migration from Central America for close to 20 years now. So it was before these administrations. And so far, it's not very evident how those, quote, collaborations have gone.
The World's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Espionage, forgery, supporting a criminal organization, those are pretty serious charges, and it's what 24 humanitarian aid workers are facing in Greece. Today, their case went to trial. Human rights groups say the charges are baseless and politically motivated. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has that story.
Sean Binder traveled to the Greek island of Lesbos in 2017 to work with a local NGO. Binder, who's a German national, grew up in Ireland. The 27-year-old is one of those two dozen aid workers facing criminal charges. We spoke by phone yesterday and I asked Binder how he was feeling.
Calmer than I expected, but some mix of frustration and anger, I suppose, that wouldn't have to go through this process at all.
He says he went to Lesbos because he was moved by the images of crowded migrant boats arriving off the Greek coast. After a year, Binder and several other aid workers were accused of a series of crimes, including espionage, forgery, and even more serious offences.
The felonies are establishing a criminal organisation, migrant smuggling, fraud, and the crime of money laundering.
Zacharias Kessis is Binder's lawyer. Kessis says the NGO workers were targeted by Greek authorities because they're well known. He says the intention was to deter other aid workers from travelling to the island to help migrants. Hannah Behrens, the director of Migration Policy Institute Europe, agrees.
Even if the court case results in acquitting the person or the NGO for months and years while that court case is pending, you send a signal to all other individuals or NGOs who are tempted to support refugees or migrants to do something similar.
Binder and his colleague Sarah Mardini are the most well-known of the aid workers who went on trial today. Mardini is from Syria. She fled to Greece with her sister Yusra in 2015. The sisters made international headlines after dragging their sinking refugee boat to safety. Mardini spoke about the crossing from Turkey to Greece in a TED talk in 2019.
15 minutes actually after we left the shoreline, we start sinking because it's overcrowded. And then some of the men on the boat get with the idea, why don't we jump in the water, make it light? Then I look to myself, I'm a lifeguard. I cannot live with the guilt that actually someone dies on that boat.
The sisters dived into the water and pulled the rubber boat for 3.5 hours. All 20 people on board survived. The Mardinis eventually made it to Germany, where they were granted asylum. But in 2018, Sarah Mardini returned to Greece as a volunteer to help other refugees arriving by sea. Mardini wasn't in court today because she's barred from travelling to Greece. But Sean Binder says the trial isn't just about them.
If you see somebody in the water, like I have seen, that is struggling and is in distress, what would you do? You would also, anybody else would also put their arm out and try to pull them out. And as soon as they've done so, they've committed the same supposed crime that I've committed.
The case has grabbed international attention. In the European Parliament last week, Irish lawmaker Grace O'Sullivan called for the charges to be dropped.
Their crime, providing a warm and often life-saving welcome to people on one of the most dangerous migration routes in the world. They are accused of being members of a criminal organisation, a humanitarian NGO which worked with local authorities to distribute blankets and basic medical care.
More than 70 EU lawmakers have since written an open letter supporting her appeal. The Conservative government in Greece has taken a harder line on migration since coming to office in 2019. Recently, the Greek Coast Guard was accused of illegally forcing migrants to turn back to Turkey. When a journalist asked the Greek Prime Minister about that a few days ago, Kyriakos Mitsotakis was not happy.
Look, you will not come into this building and insult me. Am I very clear on this? I'm answering now and you will not interrupt me.
Mitsotakis said his country was out rescuing people at sea every single day. Lawyer Zacharias Kessis says all the political pressure around this case helps, but it may have little actual impact in the courtroom. I ask aid worker Sean Binder if he regrets ever going to Lesbos to volunteer.
Not at all. Of course not. Regret trying to help people? I mean, but no, of course not. And one should never regret that.
This morning, journalists were prevented from entering the courthouse in Lesbos. Greek officials said that was because of COVID restrictions. A short time later, the judge ruled that the case should be heard in a higher court and brought today's proceedings to a close. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
The National Book Award winners were announced last night. It is one of the most closely watched literary competitions in the world. But there's another contest underway, one slightly less prestigious. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reads us in.
The Diagram Prize for the oddest book title of the year started in 1978 as a way for two bored publishers to pass the time at the Frankfurt Book Fair.
Right now, the Frankfurt Book Fair is probably one of the busiest times of the year for publishers. But back in the 70s, it wasn't too busy.
Tom Tivnan works at Bookseller Magazine in the UK and oversees the Diagram Prize.
So Trevor Bonford and Bruce Robertson were sitting around, had nothing to do, and they were looking around the halls, which have a lot of academic books from people writing on very esoteric topics. And they were saying, oh, look at these really odd titles. Why don't we do a prize for the oddest title in the Frankfurt Book Fair?
The book that won that year was The Proceedings for the Second International Workshop on Nude Mice.
By the University of Tokyo Press.
Since then, the competition has expanded. Anyone can vote, any book can be nominated, but the titles are still refreshingly unusual. Some of the books on this year's shortlist are
Curves for the Mathematically Curious. The second one is Hats, A Very Unnatural History. The next one is Superman Circumcised? A question we've all been asking ourselves. And Miss, I Don't Give a Shit, Engaging with Challenging Behavior in Schools.
All of the books on this list are serious books. Even the one about the Man of Steel, if you know what I mean, is about the Jewish origins of Superman. Tom thinks that one is sure to win this year's prize.
This is a sad commentary on we, the general public, but since we opened it to the public voting in 2000, the sort of scatological, the mention even obliquely of genitals often gets a good push from the public.
Tom's all-time favorite?
Managing a Dental Practice the Genghis Khan Way.
What a perfect holiday gift for any dentist in the family, or maybe for our pledge drive? You can still vote for this year's winner until November 26th. Just type Bookseller Magazine, Diagram Prize, Vote Now into your search engine. The prize goes to the person who nominated the winning book. Tom says it's a passable bottle of red wine.
The author and the publisher of the book don't get anything, except glory, of course.
May the most esoteric title win. For the World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Booster shots are widely available in the U.S., while many countries are struggling to get just the first shots of a COVID-19 vaccine into people's arms. An ethicist explains her decision to get a booster. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's nearing 3 months since the U.S. left Afghanistan after a 20-year war and that frantic rush to evacuate tens of thousands of people from the country. About 46,000 Afghans remain at military bases in the U.S. waiting to be resettled. As The World's Monica Campbell reports, thousands more hoping to reach the U.S. are still in Afghanistan, including many who helped U.S. forces.
The video from August shows crowds of people rushing the Kabul airport, hoping to get a plane out. It was just days before the U.S. withdrawal. Thousands were trying to escape Taliban rule. Many failed, including Yawari. He's 28 and the father of two young girls.
Still no good news, unfortunately. And still I'm stranded in Kabul without any help.
Yawari is speaking by phone from a relative's home in Kabul.
It's a basement, actually. It's a small room I'm living in.
He and his family are in hiding after fleeing their home in another part of Afghanistan.
I just told my neighbor to look after my house, and I left everything there. Even I didn't tell my father where I'm going.
Yawari worked for U.S. military contractors to help run radio networks for Afghan forces. That's what made him a Taliban target and why he's asked to use his last name only. Now, he says, his wife is the only one who leaves the house to get food. He sought a special immigrant visa for Afghans who helped U.S. forces, but the airlifts came and went without him.
We who have assisted U.S. international troops, so we are in a great danger and they're not evacuating us.
Yawari joins many other Afghans at risk under Taliban rule who are applying to reach the U.S. In an email, a State Department spokesperson wrote me that officials are trying to help Afghans like Yawari, but that it's hard to process visas for anyone in the country without an embassy there. Advocates say more can and should be done.
There are thousands of people that were approved for visas that were left behind.
Sunil Varghese is with the International Refugee Assistance Project in Washington, D.C.
And what we're trying to just alert the public and alert the administration is that, no, we have a legal and moral obligation to continue to help those that worked for on behalf of the U.S. and other vulnerable Afghans.
Another way out is through what's called humanitarian parole. It's a pass into the U.S. set aside for extreme circumstances like a medical emergency. Thousands of Afghans are trying this last-ditch approach.
We trained a bunch of legal volunteers and matched them with folks who had reached out to us for assistance.
Leila Ayoub is a lawyer with the Afghan Network for Advocacy and Resources, assisting many Afghans trying to get humanitarian parole. The U.S. agency, though, that handles these applications is facing a big pileup. The agency has yet to give Ayoub's group any up or down decisions.
We have been very clear with people from the beginning that this is really difficult. It might not work.
Then there are the Afghans who'd applied to enter the U.S., but in the chaos of the evacuation were flown to other countries. Now they're in limbo. Spojami Nasiri is an immigration lawyer in California. She's helping one Afghan man who was sent to the Netherlands in August.
And how he got in a Dutch plane and how he ended up in Amsterdam is, he said, they just said, go to that plane, and he just got on that plane.
Now he's in a holding facility for refugees, waiting to hear from U.S. officials. His wife has a green card, and he thought he'd be with her in the States by now.
He said he's having anxiety, insomnia, stress.
In Kabul, Yawari is following the news about all of this. For him, leaving Afghanistan couldn't be more urgent. He says he feels hunted by the Taliban.
The Taliban have checkpoints everywhere.
He was filled with fear just this week.
Two nights ago, they were searching the alley beside us, and I was awake all night.
Up and alert, with the curtains closed, he says, hoping there wouldn't be a knock on his door. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
COVID cases are ticking upward in many parts of the globe. It's worrying many here in the U.S. as well, especially as we plan Thanksgiving gatherings. But booster shots can make a big difference. An announcement is expected soon to make COVID boosters widely available for most Americans. Still, many people struggle with the idea of getting a third vaccination before others. People who are at greater risk in low-income countries, many haven't even had a first shot. It's something that Nicole Hassoun has given a lot of thought to. She's a professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. We have new data, Nicole, about how effective boosters can be in tamping down COVID surges. How do you think we should approach booster shots, given the global inequality around vaccination?
Well, I think it's really important to get shots in arms everywhere, that people really need those first shots because those are really effective in reducing transmission and saving lives. And it's a tragedy that we're giving people their third doses before many people even have their first doses. We're going to see more mutation of the virus globally, and we're not as effectively combating the global pandemic as we could be.
Let's work through that tragedy. I mean, the idea that getting a booster shot is sort of jumping the line, would you say that has merit?
I have personally gotten my booster shot, so I'm not a person who thinks it's fully the responsibility of individuals to make sure that that equity happens. I think it's the responsibility of our governments primarily, and it leaves individuals in a terrible situation. In this case, with boosters, my personal decision has to do with the fact that I'm going to visit a nursing home where my father is. So in a perfectly competitive market, if I don't take it, there'll be an extra dose to give to somebody else. But I don't think that's how it's actually going to work. And that's largely because a lot of the vaccines given and the vaccine that I took, Pfizer, has to have an incredibly robust cold chain. And it's a limited time span on getting those shots in arms. So I would much rather have given that shot to someone who hasn't been vaccinated at all in the U.S., for instance, but it's not going to happen.
So by not taking a booster, it's not like that goes to a person who may need it more in, say, Africa. Again, the quandary. But is that a morally well-grounded way of thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be great if we could donate more vaccines or just not take them up in the first place. But I think, you know, there's a lot of factors at play in getting to this unjust situation. And we should look at, you know, governments and what the pharmaceutical industry is doing and how international law is working, and not always at the individual level. So if we have a chance for a good pandemic treaty and future support for an implementation of something like COVAX that would really work internationally, and that's going to be discussed at the World Health Assembly at the end of the month, I think that's something that's really important. And we should require companies to share the knowledge, data, and technology that allows global manufacturing of those technologies and to be scaled up really widely.
You spoke earlier about visiting your father in a group home. Can I ask you, Nicole, how personally you approach the question of if or when to get a booster?
I mean, I think it's a really difficult choice. I don't think that it would probably have gotten into an arm had I not taken it. And so given that, I think it's really important for them to get in arms, I wouldn't advocate for individuals not taking it. I think that individuals need to demand of their governments that they advance equity and good public health policies. And then I also think there's ways for us to try to help support the global vaccination effort that would be more effective than refusing a booster shot ourselves, especially if you're likely to come into contact with vulnerable people or could transmit the virus to unvaccinated people. So.
Nicole Hassoun is a professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. She's also the head of the Global Health Impact Project, which advocates for essential health technologies around the world, speaking with us about the ethics of getting a booster shot. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World. Air and water quality in China can be a problem. A performance artist known as Nut Brother is bringing attention to the pollution. His work veers toward dark humor and the absurd.
It's trying to create this kind of sense of helplessness, how limited an individual's power or strength is.
The artist is flexing, though. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It has been more than 10 months since a mob stormed the U.S. Capitol. The Justice Department has called the aftermath the largest criminal investigation in U.S. history. Charges have been filed against more than 675 people. One of the accused is Evan Newman, a middle-aged man from Mill Valley, California. His whereabouts unknown until this month, when Newman surfaced in a country that's been in the news for other reasons, Belarus. The World's Daniel Offman has our story.
On January 6th, as the attack on the Capitol building played out in real time, the whole world seemed to be watching. For some world leaders, this was an opportunity.
У нас протестующие и прочие недовольные не штурмуют
That's the authoritarian leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, speaking a few days after the Capitol riot. He said that in Belarus, protesters don't storm government buildings and that democracy in Belarus is developing steadily. Russian President Vladimir Putin made the most of this moment as well.
Вот с политическими требованиями люди вошли в Конгресс США после выборов.
Putin spoke about January 6 during a news conference in Geneva back in June. It was immediately following a summit with President Joe Biden. Putin said that protesters were just making political demands, and now they're facing long prison sentences. He said he feels bad about what happened in the U.S., but that he doesn't want anything like that to happen in Russia.
Но мы не хотим допустить, чтобы то же самое происходило у нас.
For both Putin and Lukashenko, strong men who've been in power for at least 20 years, the Capitol riot was a prime example to highlight the dark side of Western democracy. And this is where Evan Newman comes into the picture.
Agents are looking for a Mill Valley man who's been charged in the Capitol riot in January.
48-year-old Evan Newman of Mill Valley. He is charged with attacking police at the U.S. Capitol this year.
Newman is on the FBI's most wanted list. He's facing six felony charges, including assaulting police officers. But his exact whereabouts were unknown until just last week.
Американец, которого ищут спецслужбы США.
They released a picture of him.
Evan Newman was featured in a 17-minute report on Belarusian state TV.
Goodbye, America. Смотрите прямо сейчас.
According to the story, Newman left the U.S. on a business trip. He says he went into hiding after he found out he was wanted by the FBI. More than once in the TV report, Newman denies any wrongdoing. He says the charges against him are unfounded.
Different people had different reasons.
Newman goes on to explain why he attended the January 6th riot. He airs multiple conspiracy theories, alleging that the storming of the Capitol building was an inside job and that Joe Biden stole the election. Now, why would Belarus be so interested in sharing Newman's version of the story? Here's Katya Glod. She's a senior fellow with the Center for European Policy Analysis.
The way the West is portrayed is always very negative. The language is really goes over the top without any reservation. It's basically an unconscious stream of hatred language.
Glod says that trend became even sharper in the last year or so following a contested presidential election in Belarus. The U.S. and the European Union accuse Alexander Lukashenko of rigging the election. Since then, Lukashenko's regime has pushed an alternate narrative in state media.
It's all supportive of Lukashenko, always saying that the West is doing something nasty, that it's waging a war against Belarus, that the situation is very bad every way except for Belarus. And it's all thanks to the regime that the country still holds together, that it has not been occupied by the West.
The perspective from an American like Evan Newman fits perfectly. And state-run media in Russia is on the story too.
Evan, good evening, добрый вечер, слышите меня?
Over the weekend, Evan Newman appeared on NTV, a pro-Kremlin channel. He told the host that Americans accused of participating in the Capitol riot are all being held in solitary confinement and being tortured. The host never followed up on those allegations, but he did ask Newman what he's planning to do now and if he will seek asylum in Belarus.
Yes. Yes, pending.
As Newman hesitated to answer, the host repeated the question.
Yes. Say yes.
Newman went on to say that he doesn't trust the U.S. justice system and that he has no plan on turning himself into authorities. I reached out to members of Evan Newman's family and they have not responded. The FBI has laid out details of its charges against Newman in a court document. Images from police body cameras show him holding onto a metal barricade in what appears to be a physical altercation with police. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
As the globe has been focused on the COVID health crisis, another public health epidemic has reached alarming levels. More than 100,000 people died of drug overdoses in the U.S. during the year that ended in April 2021. That's according to the CDC. That is the highest number ever. Notable as well, the opioid fentanyl accounts for 2/3 of those fatalities. We wanted to put this into a global context, so we reached out to Dan Ciccarone. He teaches family community medicine at UC San Francisco and has written extensively about the rise of fentanyl and similar products. Dr. Ciccarone, 100,000 drug overdoses in a single year. As you look around the globe, is the U.S. an outlier with that historically high number?
You know, the U.S. has the greatest number of overdoses. It's not alone. Our neighbor to the north, Canada, also has a large problem with fentanyl. And there's other countries where fentanyl has been known to be problematic. But I would say the U.S. and Canada do have the largest problem.
The new data from the CDC shows that in the U.S. there are now more overdose deaths from fentanyl than there were overdose deaths from all drugs in 2016. Remind us, first of all, what fentanyl and its related products are.
So fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. The world of opioids includes those that come out of the poppy plant, out of opium. We use those to treat pain. Fentanyl as a synthetic is also used in medicine to treat pain. It's used in anesthesia. But the product that we're talking about here is not a pharmaceutical product. It's not a diverted product. It is illicitly manufactured fentanyl. The main source are illicit elements within China, and it's routed through Canada, sold straight into the United States, and also routed in a large way through Mexican criminal trafficking organizations. There's also production in Estonia. There's been a couple of Eastern European countries that have been affected by fentanyl in the last 10 or so years. It doesn't seem to spread very far through Europe, though. A lot of European countries, the UK, have largely been spared the fentanyl problem.
For some time, I know a big concern was the Postal Service. Fentanyl is so potent that a very small amount can be fatal, so it was easy for dealers to hide it in an envelope. Is that still a problem?
So that would be purchases through the dark web. The thing about the dark web is you have to know how to use it. You have to be able to navigate Tor servers. You have to own cryptocurrency. A lot of people do, but a larger number of people don't. According to the DEA data, it's a small volume, but it's a high-quality product that's coming in. So if you buy on the dark web, you can get good stuff. You have to pay extra for it. It's not the main thing that's making it to American streets right now. The main thing that's making it to American streets is probably of Mexican criminal origin, and to some degree, with this counterfeit pill thing, Canadian origin. There's product coming down from Canada that's high-quality counterfeit pills. There's very little government data on this. I think it's a subject we'll be talking a lot about in the next year or two as we put a greater spotlight on it.
Why is it so hard for the U.S. to prevent fentanyl from entering the country?
It's because of that small volume. So I wrote a paper years ago showing that heroin had become the cheapest and purest product that we'd ever seen because of trade agreements, because we have goods and services flowing into America at greater rates every year that are imported products. It's easy to hide the illicit with the licit, right? So as we promote greater international trade, along with that come the illicits. And you can't stop them because they're hard to detect. We have a good bilateral agreement with China to stop fentanyl production. The only outcome that I can see from that is that we've stopped some of the diversity in fentanyl analogs. We've slowed those down, but we're still seeing a lot of the mother chemical, which is fentanyl.
Dan Ciccarone teaches family community medicine at UC San Francisco and has written extensively about the rise of fentanyl and similar products. Dan, thank you very much for unpacking this with us.
Marco, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Islam is the third largest religion in America, and it's growing. But for some Americans, including Muslim converts, there's still a sense that Islam is somehow foreign or other. That's one of the takeaways from the book, Islam is a Foreign Country, by Yale anthropologist Zarina Grewal. It helps explain, she says, why many American converts to Islam choose to go abroad to learn about their faith.
You know, when you're coming from a place like the U.S. where, you know, you have the daily onslaught of anti-Muslim racism and horrific news of warfare and all this other stuff, to be able to be in a place where Islam is beautiful architecture, Islam is a thriving culture, Islam is jokes and food and traditions and family and the banal.
Grewal spoke with reporter Jad Khalil for part of the Spiritual Edge podcast. Jad also profiled an American student named Diana Demchenko. She moved to Cairo to gain a closer understanding of Islam.
Cairo has so much energy, sound, and smells
that sometimes you can't even notice them. Islam is kind of the same. Its presence switches from being front and center and being so ordinary it's almost invisible. When Deanna arrived in Egypt, she found a vibrant scene.
So many students there, and I didn't expect it at all. I met students from all over the world, like literally all over the world, from the States, from Netherlands, France, UK.
Zarina Grewal said it's hard to count, but there were probably upwards of 1,000 American students like Deanna coming to Egypt each year before the Arab Spring disrupted that flow. And the students weren't just from the U.S.
Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, New Zealand, Thailand, South Africa, Senegal, like everywhere.
One thing that brings a lot of students to Cairo is that it's had an operating university and teaching system since the 10th century. Some students were there just to memorize the Quran.
They weren't even focused on Arabic. They were just like, I just want to memorize and here it's easier to do it.
Some like Deanna were there to study the Arabic of the Quran. Vocab, grammar, syntax.
You could say like alama versus alama or alama.
And some classmates were just there.
Chilling and just hanging out.
When Deanna got out into the city, she had to confront what she thought she knew about Islam. Remember that beautiful mosque her first week in Cairo? Well, she went next door to another mosque, the Rifai Mosque.
Every inch of the building has some kind of a design, some kind of an etching, some kind of an artwork, whether it's the lighting that's the artwork, whether it's the way that the wall is painted, and the colors inside, oh my God, they're just so beautiful. And you're standing and you just can't take your eyes off of the place.
When Deanna visited the Rifai Mosque, she came across something special.
There was actually a Maulid going on there, and I was like, whoa!
A Maulid is a celebration of a religious figure. Sometimes they're referred to as saint festivals. In Egypt and Sudan, they're huge parties with carnival games, street food, and parades. But of course, there's a religious part. Charity, religious songs, and in some cases, rhythmic dancing that puts people into trances to remember God. Maulids are often associated with Sufism, which is a mystical way of thinking about Islam. Roots in mysticism and folklore mean that some other preachers and their followers don't approve of it. And other Muslim traditions just don't really celebrate Maulids. When Deanna was in the U.S., she said Muslims that she knew demonized Sufis.
Like in the first like month or two of me being Muslim and just trying to understand anything, I remember somebody was like, okay, here's some advice for the rest of your life. Stay away from Sufis, they do weird stuff.
I noticed something about Deanna, that even though she was taught, or rather told certain things about Islam, she kept an open mind. When she encountered Sufism in real life, it spoke to her existential curiosity about being.
The Tasawwuf side of things more kind of like teaches you like, okay, here's like from an internal perspective, from your heart perspective, like, okay, why do people die? Why do scary things happen to us?
As Deanna was getting more interested in Sufism, she was joining other Muslims in a global marketplace of ideas, according to Zarina Grewal.
Well, what kind of community is the right fit? Or what is the learning, what network will you choose to study with? Because to decide who to study with is to say, in a way, what kind of Islam do you find to be most authentic?
As Deanna got deeper into her faith and met more Muslims and became more devout, she was less concerned with being outwardly religious. Cairo gave her a new confidence and perspective to practice Islam on her own terms, rather than looking for an exact framework to emulate. When I was speaking to Zarina Grewal, she said that sometimes white American converts like Deanna were treated differently, either as a kind of redemptive victory over America or an object of suspicion that they weren't fully Muslim. Deanna said she never felt that way.
I've never had a situation where I felt like the person was trying to see if I'm like a real Muslim, quote unquote. People would be out of just curiosity asking like, oh, do you read Quran or do you know how to say this? There was a taxi driver who like, he could tell that I'm obviously not Egyptian from like the way that I'm speaking, like struggling to speak. And he asked me what I'm doing here, what I'm up to, you know, things like that. And he's like, oh my God, you read Quran. Oh, can you read something for me? So I start reading the chapter of the cave, which like a lot of Muslims read on Fridays. And we just started reading it together, like popcorn style. Like I read a few lines, he read a few lines. I read a few lines, he read a few lines. And he was doing it with so much like heart and so much smile and so much happiness.
Deanna's tag team recitation with that driver was in the first week of 2020. Little did she, or any of us for that matter, know that her time in Cairo was about to come to an abrupt end. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, she had to come home to California and was more or less kicked out of this new, refreshing environment of being around so many Muslims. But she had been there long enough to learn something important.
The more Muslims that you're around and the more Muslims that you see just living their lives and being practicing Muslims and just seeing how Islam interacts in their life really definitely did help me to understand, like, okay, Islam is not about doing 100 things in a day that are quote-unquote Muslimy things.
A lot of the transformation that happens for people when they're overseas doing this kind of soul-searching and studying of their religion is precisely that process of saying, you know, there isn't X number of books or X number of hoops that I can jump through to finally feel Muslim. I really have to understand that I'm not going to get closer to God just because I'm in Damascus. I have to be able to feel close to God in Detroit, too.
For all of Deanna's new confidence and sense of community, my sense is that she's going to keep searching.
Islam is such an ocean of knowledge that I feel like I've barely even like put my pinky in it. I want to be able to look back at my life and be in a place where, you know, that I'll have a purer, better, more loving, more beautiful heart. And so it's a lifelong journey for sure. How that will look like exactly, I'm not sure. I hope to be able to continue to learn however that will look like and wherever that will be.
Reporter Jad Khalil brought us that story as part of the podcast The Spiritual Edge, produced by KALW in San Francisco. Climate change, pollution, disease. China is paying a steep price for its fast-paced economic growth over the past 20 years. Each week on the show, we bring you a story about how people are working to solve environmental problems. For today's big fix, we're in China.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
This week, we meet a Chinese artist who's raising awareness about pollution. As the world's Rebecca Canther reports from Shanghai, he's making a name for himself in some unusual ways.
That's the sound of an industrial vacuum cleaner. And in this video from 2015, a lanky Chinese guy with a ponytail is pushing it along Beijing's smoggy city streets. He points the vacuum nozzle not at the ground, but up into the air around him. The man is Wang Renzheng, a performance artist whose work often tackles the issue of pollution. He calls himself Jianguo Xiongdi, or Nut Brother, and his pieces revel in absurdity. For that dust project, he wandered through Beijing's streets for 100 days, sucking up dust with his vacuum. Then he combined the dust with clay to make a brick. He brought it to a residential construction site, and a bricklayer slapped on some mortar and laid it down among countless other bricks. Since then, Nut Brother has taken on even more ambitious art projects. In 2018, he purchased 9,000 bottles of spring water and donated them to a village in northern Shanxi province that had been plagued by water pollution from nearby coal mines. In a video put out on the internet, Nut Brother points out that the water is clearly murky and polluted. He says it has a strange taste to it, and that it's all the people and the animals have to drink. Nut Brother says in the video, people in the countryside are more affected by water pollution, and their legal rights are less protected. It's just as serious as air pollution, he says. News about Nut Brother's performance piece went viral and brought results. Local government officials launched an investigation into village water quality and later announced they were investing in a new water purification system. But not everyone appreciates what he's doing. Local authorities will sometimes invite him for tea, which is slang for getting called in to talk to police. They're embarrassed by the amount of attention his work is getting and the problems he's highlighting. Gu Ling works in the art scene in the southern city of Shenzhen and has been following Nut Brother's work for years.
I mean, for him, the role of artist is also kind of social activist for sure.
She says he has developed his own brand of dark humor in his work.
It's trying to create this kind of sense of helplessness. how limited an individual's power or strength is. And maybe we could laugh at kind of awkwardness or strangeness created by these situations.
Sometimes Nutt Brothers' work borders on the ridiculous. Earlier this year, he put out a video of a river polluted by heavy metal residue. He and another guy put large inflatable dead fish and fake hot peppers into the reddish-brown river water to make it look like a giant cauldron of hot pot soup. While the locals watch, the men stir the water with long sticks and call out for customers. Chinese news media called it the world's largest hot pot. But the message was clear. The water is so polluted, nothing in it could live. Now, Nutt Brother is at it again, embarking on a tour of China's countryside to visit places where residents have complained about water and soil pollution. Volunteers collect sewage water flowing into a river to conduct tests. Nutt Brother has a heavy metal band perform a song about pollution right at the entrance to an abandoned coal mine that is leaking manganese and iron into the ground. He calls it using heavy metal music to raise awareness about heavy metal pollution. The tour has not gone entirely smoothly. At several stops along the way, Nutt Brother and his team have been harassed by authorities. Last month, Nutt Brother posted this video of the band performing a show in Hunan province. The video shows authorities preventing Nutt Brother and the band from leaving their hotel. So they end up turning their hotel bed into a stage and performing in front of a small group. Nutt Brother told me in text messages he's avoiding interviews with foreign media so that he can complete the heavy metal tour. And he's already working on new pieces that call attention to China's problem with pollution. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
The Big Fix is our weekly look at how people fight climate change, from wine growers in France experimenting with grape varieties to climate activists using the courts to press their cause. Find that reporting and more at theworld.org/bigfix. Sometimes a performance by a heavy metal act is just heavy metal, but not all heavy metal follows the same beat. This, for example, our friends at the PRX program Afropop Worldwide assure us that this band, Arkan, is the only heavy metal band in Togo in West Africa. It doesn't sound like it, but wait. Ah, there's that heavy metal sound we know and love. For Arkan, they distill that sound through a Togolese lens. The band doesn't typically play in rock and roll 4/4 time. They also use local percussion like bells and shakers and sing in the Ewe language and in French and English. They also have trouble winning over Togolese fans, but that has not deterred Arkan from following their warrior spirit, which infuses almost all their music. This track from their self-produced album, Zakeli, is called Warrior Song. Togolese heavy metalheads Arkan dropping us off on the other side of this Thursday edition of The World. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, online all the time at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.